You're with Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, good hour coming up, so don't go anywhere. We'll get to former intelligence officer and terror expert Shane Healy very shortly. We'll talk about the Middle East and also some terror issues related to Australia. And also Rebecca Barnett, she's got a lot to do and say on the eSafety Commissioner. She's done some homework, a little bit more than what you have read and what you have heard. So we'll speak with her a little later this hour. And don't forget our Please Explain skits, courtesy of the very clever writers at One Nation, coming up towards the end of the program. Some 78 Victoria police officers and protective service officers are facing criminal charges and traffic offences, with a disturbing number relating to serious sex offences, including rape, sexual assault, and indecent acts against children, including possessing and producing child pornography. What did we discuss last hour with Jim about institutions protecting predators? Well, I discussed it in reference to the Harvey Weinstein story. Three charges of rape and five sexual assault charges against police are among 19 sex charges before the courts, in addition to a range of sex offences allegedly committed against children under the age of 16. It's a worry, isn't it? One police officer faces a charge of incest relating to a sibling. The police crime data released by Victoria Police after a request from the Australian newspaper cover offences allegedly committed by 68 officers on and off duty. A further five police officers are facing traffic charges in court. We ignore that one. The 73 police officers facing charges include seven first constables, 20 senior constables, 26 leading senior constables, 14 sergeants, five senior sergeants, and one ranked inspector or above, because they're facing a total of 130 different charges. There you go. It's a pity the information had to be asked for by the Australian and it wasn't something that was freely available. Meanwhile, to the UK, and King Charles's health condition is progressively deteriorating, according to news.com.au. This is from a leading Buckingham Palace official who keeps a regular updated plan for his impending funeral, preparations for which started the day after Queen Elizabeth was buried, insiders said. Gee, they're presumptuous, aren't they? Morbidly presumptuous. The 75-year-old monarch has remained largely out of the limelight since announcing his cancer prognosis in the second month of the year to hide his declining condition, with multiple sources telling the Daily Beast the situation is not good. Of course, he is determined to beat it, and they are throwing everything at it. Everyone is staying optimistic, but he is really very unwell. More than they are letting on, a source described as an old friend of the royal family told the outlet. King Charles has never revealed what cancer he has been diagnosed with, but admitted that it wasn't prostate cancer, which is one of the most treatable forms of the disease. The firm has also been tight-lipped on his medical journey, but well-placed insiders and political commentators have publicly spoken about how the king is responding really well to treatment, whatever that means. Behind the scenes, however, King Charles's aides are regularly reviewing copies of a several hundred-page document outlining his royal funeral plans, dubbed Operation Menai Bridge. The plans have been dusted off and are actively being kept up to date. It's no more than what you would expect, given the king has been diagnosed with cancer, but the circulation of them has certainly focused minds, according to a former staffer who spoke to the Daily Beast. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Let's get to a man who's worked in the Australian Army as an intelligence officer and trainer, and also as a private military contractor. He was deployed twice to Afghanistan. He was part of the Tactical Assault Group East and West, and was involved in several real-time terrorist incidents. He now works for both government and private firms in the area of threat assessment. He's on the line right now. Shane Healy, welcome back to TNT. He was just on the line and has his line dropped out. Maybe his line... I've got you there, Shane. How are you?
Good, mate. Sorry.
We've got a rough line. We'll see how we go. We might have to call you back and try and get a better line. Okay, let's talk about what's happening in the Middle East, if I may. The Iranian president has issued his most shocking threat yet about the price Israel may pay for their recent attack on Iran. Ibrahim Rais Israeli said the attack on Iran's territory would mean the end of the Zionist regime. This is not over by a long shot. What are your calls on this? What are you expecting?
We'll look at a couple of things. Part of this is to, it was at an army parade in Iran, so he was really, so it's not so much to the international community, and we're seeing this with Netanyahu when he's really trying to shore up his support inside of Israel. Sometimes, you know, I look for indicators and warnings of their actions, like when we saw the build-up of drones prior to the recent Iranian attack. So I just think there's a lot more rhetoric than actual intent behind some of these words. But the ball's in Israel's court at the moment. They're the ones that are looking to conduct the next attack.
Okay. Iran is likely to not lose face in front of their people and attack in some form. But the likelihood of them having, they might have a dirty bomb, but the likelihood of them having a nuclear bomb is very, very minuscule, isn't it, according to intelligence reports?
And, you know, as I previously discussed, that was my field for 10 years, and I can pretty much guarantee that if the Five Eyes, the US and the UK especially, and Saudi Arabia thought that the Iran had nuclear capability, they would have struck already.
Yeah. All right. The US and 17 other countries, including the UK, France and Germany, are calling for the release of hostages by Hamas and saying that there is a deal on the table which offers an immediate and prolonged ceasefire in Gaza in return for those hostages. In the letter, they write, the fate of the hostages and the civilian population in Gaza, who are protected under international law, is of international concern. Finally, some focus, Shane, on the other innocent victims, you know, the ones who may be left as far as hostages are concerned.
This is really Hamas' major kind of ended on their terms. I think they've come to the conclusion that we did a number of weeks ago that this is really Netanyahu's fight to stay in power. And so they've really put the pressure on him, and they're using the international community to do it. So as much as I dislike Hamas and their ideology, I've got to congratulate them on this part. They're really trying to put the pressure back on the Israeli government.
What does it mean, though? What are Hamas likely to do? They seem to always want to have a full deck of cards when they start dealing. And I don't get the impression that they want any kind of ceasefire unless they get a lot more in return.
Well, there were some comments that some of the international leaders are making about the two-state solution, and I think they're trying to build on that momentum. And they've also come out in that statement and said, you know, we will release hostages and we will lay our arms down tomorrow if a two-state solution can be agreed upon. And this is partly because Netanyahu has come out so firmly and said that the two-state solution is off the table. So this has kind of allowed Hamas to be the good guys, because saying, hey, we don't want to keep fighting. We want peace. We want to end hostilities. We'll give you the hostages back. All we want in return is a place of our own. And that's put a lot of geopolitical pressure back on the Israelis, who are already under the pump, you know, with some of the other countries calling them war criminals and the UN looking to do some investigation. So I think this was a strategically smart move by Hamas, because they've really put Netanyahu under pressure, because as we know, there's a lot of trouble in Israel for the same thing. They just want the hostages back. They want the war to go away. So I think both internally and externally now, Netanyahu's really been backed in a corner.
I wonder how many hostages are still alive though, mate.
That's an excellent point. And I think, I know that there's a lot of intelligence unit collection on the ground from a number of countries now really trying to answer that question. And I think that I had conversations recently with some colleagues that are involved, and that's what they've been tasked to do, to really nut out the locations, internal and external to Gaza, of hostages and that number.
Mm. All right, to the biggest story coming out of the Middle East, the United Nations has called for a clear, transparent and credible investigation of mass graves, which were uncovered at two major hospitals in war-torn Gaza. We've been running the story for most of the day in our news. Now, these were places that had been raided by Israeli troops. So the accusation is that it was the Israelis who have created these 392 graves, which is quite possible. It's also possible that it wasn't the Israelis. AP reports that the UN wants investigators to have access to the sites, and they also want more journalists needed to be able to work safely in Gaza to report on the facts. Now, just on that smaller aspect of trying to push for more journalists on the front line, it all sounds perfect in theory, but I wonder whether any of these same people from the UN have ever worked in a war zone, Shane.
So, without getting into a lot of detail, the UN have got a number of internal organisations that do this regularly, both in war crimes. And if you look back just to Syria in 2013 in August, after the chemical attack from Assad against his people, the UN sent investigators into Syria then to both look at the damage of those attacks and actually prove through the OPCW that Assad did use chemical weapons. The Australian Defence Force in East Timor and Rwanda have been used by the United Nations to investigate bodies and war crimes. So this is not unusual for the United Nations to do this. And one of the things I think that will come up is the Israelis would have been doing biometric collection of those, you know, DNA collection and anything else they can get, blood samples and stuff, to see if any of those bodies were Israeli hostages. So, you know, you can paint this as a number of ways, but I think, you know, I know that if it was our government, we would be sent in to collect DNA samples to try to prove or disprove if any of those bodies were Australian citizens, for example, hypothetically. So I could understand 100% the Israeli government asking the Israeli military to do that. It's very sticky when you're dealing with in an Arab country and Islamic tradition and law, where, you know, they bury the bodies very quick and, you know, you're unclean if you touch that. So I get the issues around that in that area. But I don't think there would be the nefarious side to it. I think everyone's going to have an opinion. And but if it was me, if I was making the assessment on this, I would say that one of the major reasons that the Israeli dug these bodies up was to conduct that biometric DNA exploitation in order to identify who those bodies are.
Well, that makes really good sense. It does make sense. The next step has got to be, though, is to get somewhat of an independent group of investigators, if that is at all possible, who don't have, you know, a team to choose out of, you know, between Hamas and Israel, who can go in, grab the DNA, do a proper investigation and work out who were responsible. And if Israel is seen as responsible for the deaths of 392 people, I tell you what, the world will turn on them more than they've turned on them already.
100%. And like I said, the United Nations do this quite often, and they use a lot of other humanitarian organisations to assist them. So it's not just
right.
One country, one group of people. You know, they'll use the Red Crescent, being an Islamic country, so that makes sure that those traditions are followed. There will be, no doubt, someone from the United States or a number of people from the State Department that are forensic anthropologists, you know, experts in this field. It's done very technically, it's done very efficiently, but it's not out of the realm that the United Nations do this, because, you know, when we look at the Rwanda genocide, when we look at the Indonesians when they conducted genocide against Marines in 1999. When the Islamic State went through Mosul and some of those Iraqi areas, when the Iraqi government and the US retook those areas, the United Nations go in and conduct these kind of investigations. So they're very seasoned at it, Chris. They're very good at it, and they're very transparent, because this is the one thing the world does have faith in with the UN.
And just on that smaller point where the UN is saying, hey, you've got to let more journalists in, more reporters on the ground, easier said than done in a war zone, Shane.
And you've got to get the journalists you want to go in there for a start. You know, it's all good about saying let people in, but you've got to get the people who have faith that they're not going to be targeted. And I think to a large percentage, and speaking to a number of journalists, about a risk assessment to go in there, they don't have any faith at the moment by the Israelis.
Yeah, of course they wouldn't, because of the history of the conflict so far and the number of journalists who have been killed. I've got to take a quick break, mate. We'll do that. We'll come back and speak with Shane Healy and talk further about what's happening in Gaza, but also the arrests in the last 48 hours of a series of young kids, basically teenagers, and the allegations of a potential plot, an act of terror. We'll talk to Shane Healy about that right after a break on TNT.
TNT. Sonia Paulton.
They were talking about the new report that a generation of children will fail at school and in exams as a consequence of lockdown. Susanna said, I feel we failed our children. And the others nodded in unison. But no, wait a minute, Susanna. We did not fail our children. We, i.e. people like me, we campaigned and protested. We petitioned, we shouted, we podcasted. We made endless social media posts. And we said very, very loudly and repeatedly that we are deeply, deeply concerned with the lockdown measures being applied to everyone, including children. And you, Miss Reed, and the rest of Legacy Media.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody,
and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity.
If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, back to Shane Healy, and we'll talk further about what's happening in the Middle East. This sounds rather farcical, Shane, but you might want to fill us in. Maybe we need to be a little bit more open-minded to this plan by the United States, but a giant floating pier is due to be completed in the next 2 weeks in the eastern Mediterranean, which will be pushed towards the Gaza shore to make it easier to feed starving Palestinians. Apparently, the United States is very much a part of this. How will this work, and what do you think of the idea?
Excellent idea, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have done this previously in exercises that I've seen. A lot of variances on sea state and stuff, which the Mediterranean is not known for its high waves, so it's very achievable there. So it's just essentially a massive floating pontoon, and you know, you've seen them in Sydney Harbour moving the trash. The size is a bit different, they've done this before, because one of the examples was Hawaii after the bushfires, because they need it to get in to deliver that aid.
And the alternative has been to drop aid out of the sky in random locations, and that hasn't worked, has it?
Because you can't guarantee that it's going to go where you want it or to the people who need it, and that it's going to land safely. They can continue those drops by night, and they are somewhat successful, but this will be much more productive because you have what's called an airhead, so essentially a wharf or a port that the humanitarian can control. My fear to that will be you will get a large number of refugees that will be in panicking, trying to get there, trying to get more aid, and it could become somewhat chaotic. And then who is securing that area? I know from when we would do non-combatant evacuation operations and training, usually your biggest unknowns. And if you look at evacuation of Hamid Karzai Airport when Afghanistan fell, the scenes there. So it can be somewhat chaotic at times. And to me, that's the biggest grey area or unknown in this. But as far as actually building a floating pontoon, filling it with logistical aid and moving it across, that's quite possible or probable.
All right, let's go from the Middle East to Australia now. Seven juveniles have been arrested over alleged violent extremist ideology in a series of Sydney counter-terror raids. Five of the seven teenagers have been charged. Two boys aged 17 and 14 were charged at Parramatta Children's Court yesterday with possessing or controlling violent extremist material. And two 16-year-old boys were charged with conspiring to engage in an act in preparation for or planning a terrorist act. What are we hearing about these allegations, and where did police source their evidence, Shane?
It started in the case of the first teenager that was arrested for stabbing the priest via exploitation of his devices and some other information gathered from him. They looked at his circle of friends, and that's what led them to this. My issue with this, and I've got a lot of inside information, so I'm limited to what I can say now, but the AFP Commissioner and the New South Wales Police Inspector Hudson came out, and they actually both said that the boys weren't in the process of conducting or planning to conduct an attack. So how do they get charged with an act of preparation or planning when by both the AFP and the New South Wales Police have already said that wasn't the case?
That's bizarre.
My other question is, do a presentation to magistrates and lawyers and stuff on this actual subject. And the other thing I'm quite interested in is, when did a chat group become a terror cell? And that's basically what the AFP have said. We found a chat group that these youths were in, and they were sharing information and some imagery, and that's all of a sudden become a domestic terror cell. We've seen some cases as far back as 2011, which where judges have said that's not the case, and you know, act in preparation. Well, they weren't in the preparation of any act. This to me goes back to the Thomas Harrick matter, where intervention could have been rather than arrest made. I think a lot more will come out in the next few days. The parents of the original attacker are being very, very forthcoming. And I know that on Monday night that they'll be getting interviewed by the ABC. Because normally the parents are the last to know or aren't aware all the time of what's going on. And I know everyone always says that, how do you not know? But I've been working in the juvenile space for a number of years now, especially in New South Wales, and it's quite in the online world today, parents just don't know.
Without doubt, I couldn't agree more. You're absolutely right.
Blame the parents, I think, a lot of the time is wrong. You know, I was part of an intervention of a convicted 16-year-old. In New South Wales a number of years ago, and part of that intervention was bringing the parents in and make the juvenile apologise and own up to his crimes in front of his parents. And as we walked out of the room, the mother grabbed me and one of the psychologists and our boss and was bawling her eyes out and hugging us, thanking us for saving his son. So it's a very, a lot of shame and regret in a lot of these parents for not knowing. Again, it goes back to what videos were the kids or the juveniles sharing. You know, I'm not going to say, but I guess we can guess. Where do they get that from? It's not hard to get on the internet. But for me, Chris, it goes back to if it's online, you know, you watch the press conference with the New South Wales Police Hudson, and they both say that they weren't in planning an attack, they weren't in the preparation, so how do they get charged with acts in preparation?
Exactly. It's about the caliber of their intent. This is what will be tested. It may not even get to trial.
So that's some of the questions that I've been getting from a number of people. And so threat is intent and capability. So without intent, you actually don't have threat.
Yeah. However, their friend, their 16-year-old, allegedly stabbed, and we saw it on tape, stabbed a bishop. So, you know, how much preparation do you need?
Correct. And this is what we discussed the other week. And this is what Mike Burgess has been briefing us in the ASIO threat assessments for the last number of years. It's quite probable that a young person with limited sophistication and no warning will conduct an unsophisticated attack, which is exactly what happened. And it kind of shocks me that people are surprised that the head of ASIO got an assessment correct. He's been warning the government, he's been warning the public that this was the most likely threat. When it takes place, I think we've got to congratulate him and listen to him more.
Yeah.
And overreact, which I think the government's doing. You know, I think Albanese's like hitting a pinata at the moment blindfolded. He's just swinging and swinging and not hitting anything. I think he needs to get actual experts in a room and ask them, what do we do, you know? And they're out there. Australia have got some of the greatest cannibal and extremists, especially juvenile experts in the world. They get flown around the world to provide advice to governments. Maybe our government should get these people in a room and ask them for some help. Because this threat isn't going away, Chris. This youth threat is not going away, whether it be on the right, whether it be the Salafist Islamic threat we're seeing currently. It's just going to get worse and worse with the online space becoming more and more prevalent.
Yeah, maybe we should be focusing more on what they're being incited by directly online as opposed to getting rid of some of the footage of the church at Wakeley from two Mondays ago. I'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, Shane Healy. All the very best for the weekend.
Cheers.
Good on you, mate. Thank you, Shane Healy, former ADF intelligence officer and a man who now specialises in threat assessment for both private and government entities. He's good to have on the program. Very, very interesting indeed. Got to get you a news update. How about we do that right now on TNT?
I got a news flash for you.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Israel has been accused of carrying out field executions in Gaza following the discovery of multiple mass graves in the Palestinian territory. It's been revealed the US is considering turning unused oil rigs in the Pacific Ocean into floating military bases that would be used to fire missiles and resupply US warships. And Moscow has warned it would downgrade relations with Washington if the US confiscates frozen Russian assets.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
As I mentioned to Shane Healy, it would be far more constructive to get down and dirty into the bowels of the internet to find out what is inciting these 16, 15, 14-year-old kids that police say are allegedly acting on from what they see online. So they're the direct incitements that we should be focusing on and taking off the net, as opposed to taking off, you know, real-life incidents that occurred at Wakeley only two Mondays ago. Now, in the wake of the two violent stabbings in Sydney, and we're talking about Wakeley and Bondi Junction, senior politicians and bureaucrats are promising to ramp up social media censorship, and that's what it is, supposedly to protect us, to protect our poor eyes and our poor ears from misinformation and violent content online. Well, my next guest has done some extensive research on the issue and on Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman Grant. is the key figure behind the push for more censorship. Rebecca Barnett is an independent journalist from Western Australia. She writes for her Substack, Dystopian Down Under, and advocates for Australians injured by the COVID vaccine. She joins me live from Perth in WA. Rebecca Barnett, welcome to TNT once again.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you.
Good to have you on the program. Thank you so much. Following the two knife attacks, Australia's top politicians and bureaucrats have come to some very knee-jerk conclusions. Your latest article, Australian Government Hijacks Knife Attacks to Push for Misinformation Laws, outlines the government narrative. What is it and how is it being used at the moment?
Yeah, well, so you'll remember last year the government put forward the proposed misinformation laws, which would, and misinformation and disinformation, which would give them the power under the ACMA. So at the moment we have eSafety, that's all to do with online harm, but we don't really have an agency that gets to control misinformation on the internet, and that's what the government wants to do. Yeah. They're saying misinformation causes all this harm and we need to stop it. So they proposed this bill and it was completely panned. There were 23,000 responses, 3,000 of those were proper submissions and they were reportedly mostly negative.
So the submissions about the bill itself have been overwhelmingly negative, have they?
Yeah, because it's a terrible piece of legislation.
Good.
The government is exempt. The mainstream media is exempt.
Yes.
So the definition of misinformation can only be things that people except the government or the media say.
Yes.
So on its face, it's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It is mad. And I'm so glad I didn't know that, but the overwhelming reaction has been negative. Well, there's a good start.
Yes, but what I've said in one of the article I posted today, that it's like that scene in The Devil Wears Prada where Emily Blunt, this fashion character, says, "I'm just one stomach flu away from my goal weight." The government is just one emergency away from shoving this through and getting everyone to say, no, we really do need the government to control misinformation on the internet. So,
and right now they're trying to use that as the vehicle, aren't they?
Exactly. So this whole brouhaha with Elon Musk and X and the standoff between Julie Inman Grant and Elon Musk over the Wakely stabbing footage, but also there was some genuine misinformation about the identity of the Bondi Junction stabber. And that started on social media, then Channel 7 picked it up and they amplified it without apparently fact-checking it. And the person who was misnamed is apparently going to sue now. But they're not suing social media, they're suing Channel 7.
Well, I can tell you that 2 hours ago they've agreed to a settlement. Channel 7 has agreed to a settlement against that bloke. But it's their fault for stuffing up. You don't go ahead and name someone, especially a mass murderer, unless you're absolutely sure.
Yeah, and it was poor form on everyone's part. The people on social media, Channel 7, no one should have done that, but they did. And what was interesting about that was that the Prime Minister blamed social media for it. He totally omitted the part of the corporate media. And then the politicians have used that incident.
Yep.
And then the violent footage of the Wakely stabbing together to say, we've got to haul these social media platforms into the line. They just don't have Australians' safety and wellbeing at heart. All they care about is making money. And if we're going to hold them to the law, we have to push this bill through so that we can keep you all safe.
But the greater damage was done by the corporate media company, not by social media.
Yeah, I know. And the media's gone gung-ho. Sorry, I said it got that the wrong way around, but they've gone completely gung-ho on it. And understandably, right, because Albo's not going after them for their misinformation. Albo's going after the social media sites. So, you know, there's been some stupid front pages. I don't know if you saw the one from the West.
WA.
That X marks the loser. Like it's a game of like who's the biggest loser. It's very mature. From the West.
Well, they've just become the government mouthpiece.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, you know, and I don't know. I mean, if the conversation on X would indicate from, you know, only 8% or so, 7 or 8% of Australians, adult Australians, it's more adult Australians, maybe like a quarter of adult Australians from the stats I was reading yesterday use X. So I think it's the fourth most used social media site. So a lot of the conversation around all of this misinformation and online violence and the government, we need the government to save us. A lot of that conversation is happening on other sites, but what I've observed on X is that everyone's kind of read the room and they know that this is just the government co-opting another manufactured emergency to, you know, try to shove through a really unpopular piece of legislation. So that misinfo bill is actually getting an overhaul at the moment. It's going to be retabled later this year. So they'll be riding on the coattails.
Such opportunists. Yeah. Terrible opportunists. Before we talk about Julie Inman Grant, and we'll do that in at length in a second, how is it that a federal court can presume that they have jurisdiction over the internet globally?
So apparently it's to do with how you read the remit. So the on eSafety has the power to order footage to be hidden from Australians. Apparently, eSafety is arguing that in order to properly hide it, you have to essentially globally ban it so that people with a VPN can't get around a geo-block.
And so therefore that applies, that argument would apply to every country in the world.
Yeah, conceivably.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, your recent article, Julie Inman Grant has made Australia a key player in the global censorship push, identifies Inman Grant's former roles in America and how she was initially approached to join the CIA. Please tell.
Well, that's a throwaway line. She gave an interview maybe five or six years ago where she mentioned that throwaway line. So we don't really know much more than that. I know that she'd just finished college by... She said she just finished university and the CIA approached her, but she said no. And then she went on to work in Microsoft, but working with, she worked in government briefly and then in Microsoft. She worked with the Clinton Foundation, was involved in one of apparently the first online safety summits 25 years ago. So she got into this field of online safety really early on. It's always been her passion. And she does seem genuinely passionate about it. And I don't think the issue is, I don't think anyone has an issue with her protecting children online from.
Well, that's where she started, though, Rebecca.
Yeah,
she started being appointed by Malcolm Turnbull to look after children, but now it's sort of dovetailed into a general censorship role.
Well, when she started, Malcolm Turnbull started eSafety in 2015. Julie Inman Grant came on 2 years after that in 2017. And when she came on, the remit was expanded from looking after children to also protecting adults. And that was about revenge porn. So when she onboarded to eSafety, there was a lot of news coverage about we're going to stamp out revenge porn because her agency is kind of, as far as I can tell, covering gaps in the law. So where the police couldn't adequately deal with revenge porn, her agency took that on too. So that's when adults started to, that's when it expanded from just protecting kids. But in 2021 is where this real creep into, you know, other, just creeping into opinion and things that aren't just protecting kids from, you know, sexual abuse content or whatever. So in 2021, they added in the adult cyberbullying provisions into the Online Safety Act. Yep. And there was also in the wake of the 2019 Christchurch terror attack, which went viral online, part of the Online Safety Act, as I understand it, allows Julie Inman Grant to essentially censor anything that would be considered a terrorist terror footage, which is why she's allowed to call for the Wakely stabbing to be taken down. The premise under that is that it might give people ideas. Like, that's the idea.
I tell you what, it's hardly up there with the kind of stuff we see on a daily basis, seriously.
Well, that was the point of... Australian journalist Marian De Masi did a good write-up on this yesterday, just bringing to mind a bunch of different very violent pieces of footage that have been viral on all sorts of social media.
And still available.
Still available, and no one had an issue with it. I think this is one of the main criticisms of eSafety and Julie Inman grant at the moment is that it's very, it appears to be very ad hoc and very just based on what is either ideologically in line with perhaps her personal beliefs, yeah, or perhaps even the culture of the agency, and also what is politically expedient.
Yeah, see, maybe what we're looking at here is a political intervention where, buoyed by a Labor Party that doesn't want to upset their Muslim voters in Sydney, that they want to make sure that the eSafety Commissioner would take off an allegation that a 16-year-old would stab a Christian bishop because of his extremist Islamic views. And so, therefore, they get out of this by saying, oh, it's only an allegation. I'm sorry, that is cynical. It is censorship at its worst. And it is not the kind of stuff that we expect in Australia. But more than that, Rebecca, more than that, she's unelected. She's got the power now of someone almost beyond a prime minister. And I just don't think that we're up for this. We certainly haven't been able to vote on it. We certainly haven't even discussed it publicly. Yeah, bullying, let's get rid of it. Yeah, live massacres, let's get rid of all of that. But when you've got such a significant issue as an alleged extremist Muslim follower trying to kill a bishop, this is the kind of vision that creates debate, creates controversy, and progresses trying to stop it in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the counter to that is the other argument that I said before, I guess, where people would say, oh, but people, you know, young people will watch it and get ideas and try to replicate it. And I don't really, you know, you don't even really need to go there, because I think there are other things. A guy, digital rights expert called Andrew Lowenthal, he pointed out there are just a ton of other things you can do that don't involve taking the footage down. You can put warnings on it.
Yeah.
You could just not autoplay it.
Yeah.
You could write it down in the algorithm so that
correct.
You have to go and find it.
There's a screen there, or you can have a screen where you have to press the screen to see the footage.
Yeah. So, and the point you raise about the unelected bureaucrat kind of having so much power, it is really salient when we're thinking about the misinformation bill going through, because the ACMA aren't elected either. So the eSafety actually sits in the Department of Infrastructure, same as the ACMA. So they're kind of grouped together departmentally, but they operate separately. But they will both be given extraordinary power, and they're not elected, and they don't answer to us.
Yep. Look, one quick thing before we let you go. Independent journalist Michael Schellenberger posted yesterday that Inman Grant is a key architect of the multi-governmental global online safety regulators network, which is set up to censor the speech that politicians and government bureaucrats fear the most.
Yeah, well, they would say that they've set up to keep everyone in the world safe.
Oh, yes.
So, and it's the same. It's just the old trope of protecting the children as the banner. But it's like when you lift up the banner and you look under at what's underneath it.
Correct.
There's some really dangerous things. So, yeah, bearing in mind that Julie Inman Grant said at a WEF conference 2 years ago that she thought that rights needed to be recalibrated online, like freedom of speech. So, you know, this is the mindset of the person who's essentially guiding the global coordination around what they call online safety. And as I always say, a lot of it is about online safety, but there's this portion of it that's not, and that's the bit that we're worried about.
Yes, this is not 2024. The more I see what's going on around the world, and especially in Australia, it feels like 1984. Thank you, George. Rebecca Barnett, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Good on you. Rebecca Barnett from WA. She writes for her Substack, Dystopian Down Under, if you'd like to look for it, and please do. Let's take a break. Please explain right after this on TNT.
From weather and traffic reports
to news of political developments, We turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
Absolutely. We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked at the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre, surtout que je m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with the free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride, but there's also a significant amount of pressure.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
Watching the sun come up, that's my time. I can have a cup of coffee, and every day is a new opportunity.
That's cool.
Your hands got so- Yay!
Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
You're with Chris Smith
on today's News Talk Radio,
TNT. I'll get to your calls in just 1 second, but what a week it's been for the most extraordinary attack on free speech and media transparency, or the lack thereof, we have witnessed in Australian history. And to summarise how Australia's e-safety commissioner became so powerful and had the support of a rabble of political clowns in Canberra, I think we should leave that to Pauline Hanson's team of writers and actors. Here is the latest episode of Please Explain.
Hi, it's me, Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia. And I'm a big dumb clown.
And me, Peter Dutton, the Leader of the Opposition. I'm also a big dumb clown.
I'm not a clown.
What is it, Anthony?
It's this Pauline Hanson's cartoon series, making us look like clowns again.
Well, that's preposterous. Why don't you just get him to take it off the air?
Nah, that's impossible. It's on the internet.
There's a way. Put some pants on and follow me.
Where are we going?
We're going to Karen's.
Karen's? Who's Karen?
Back in 2015, the Turnbull government launched Project Karen's, which established the office of the e-safety commissioner.
Oh, so we put a Karen in charge of keeping the internet safe.
Well, that's what we told the people anyway. But it's really all about controlling the internet, which is why we call it the Keep Australia Regulated to Enforce a Nanny State. Project Karen's.
And I don't like that. Delete. Oh, wow. So that's the e-safety commissioner.
Yep. Real name, Julie Inman Grant. A disgruntled former Twitter employee with ties to the World Economic Forum. We pay her $450,000 a year.
No. Delete.
Whoa. So she can delete anything from the internet? Pretty much. She started just deleting this dangerous, harmful stuff. But now we just let her delete whatever she wants.
Misgendering? Delete.
Doing great, Julie.
Hey, I've got to forward you a post. I've got to send it to 10 people, otherwise I'll die. Wow, she knows so much about the internet. Hey, Joy, have you seen this? It's the latest ep of the incredibly popular Pauline Hanson cartoon series. Pauline Hanson? Must delete!
Oh no, it's not working. Looks like satire's too powerful.
Well, why don't we just give her a little more government power then? It's working, look! The video's disappearing! YouTube, gone! Facebook, gone! LinkedIn, gone!
Well done, Albo. We've given Julie enough power to censor whatever she wants on the internet, and now we don't look like clowns.
Oh, what's going on? I can't hide the leaf! Hey, it's still up on X! Why can't she delete it from X? Ah! I hate X! hate Elon! Put him in jail!
He's out of control!
Stand back. She worked at Twitter, remember? She hates Elon Musk and his free speech agenda. Oh no, where did she go?
Davos.
How do you know that?
I'm looking at the receipts right now. She just spent $40,000 on flights. Looks like she's going to use taxpayer money to set up a global online safety regulator that's going to take control of the entire internet.
Well, I guess we should probably stop her, right?
Nah, we just let her go.
There's no way people are going to find out about this and make us look like clowns, are they?
Nah, doubt it, Dutton. There's no way this sort of overreach will gain worldwide attention.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Anthony. It's not like X or Elon Musk himself will personally try and stop us or anything.
Exactly. It's not like people really value freedom of speech and expression.
Definitely not. And they'll blindly trust that their government's got their best interests at heart.
Especially after COVID.
And it's not like they'll ever vote against our two-party duopoly anyway. What are they going to do, support a party like One Nation who actually stand up for Australians' freedoms?
Yeah, jeez. We'd really look like clowns then, Dutton.
Yeah, absolute clowns.
That is excellent. That is a cut above and so appropriate for what power the Australian government is now giving Julie Inman Grant to cancel what she wants right across the globe. Right across the globe. It's just outrageous. And look, censorship is to me the antithesis of transparency. And yes, transparency has its faults. Allowing free speech or free visual speech has its faults, no doubt about it. But it's a better way to go than start leaving a bureaucrat in charge of what's right and wrong. Let's go to Andrew, who's on the line right now. Andrew, you've been in touch with the people down in Kosciuszko about these Brumbies, have you?
Oh, it's moving here. Do I follow that one, mate? Come on, you've got to be real. How can I follow Pauline Hanson?
That's very good.
Funny,
you sound like one of the characters.
Oh, well, I've been practicing, you know. I watch a bit of YouTube.
So tell me about the Brumbies.
Mate, we've had news today that they are suspending all rehoming while they're investigating this. I can't say that word, sorry.
Really?
Wagga Wagga, yep. But they are still killing them. Now, yesterday, what did we do? Yesterday, we acknowledged the service of all animals on Anzac Day.
Mm.
Horses, dogs, birds, pigeons that took messages. And we honour the memory of these beautiful, majestic animals, heroic
well said.
In nature. And we're killing them?
Yeah.
Come on, give me a break. Mate, I'm inviting you to a birthday party next Thursday.
Okay.
My dog.
Your dog's turning what?
He's turning four.
Right. How are you going to celebrate?
And you know, mate, I'm going to get a meat pie, four smackos, some sour cream on top of the meat pie. And we're going to have a party on the front. Out the front of Macquarie Street, outside of New South Wales Parliament House. Everyone is welcome because you know what his birthday wish is?
What?
He didn't get shot. I saved him. He wants some Brumbies saved.
Yeah, right. So you're going to mount, through your dog's birthday, you're going to mount a little mini protest out the front of New South Wales Parliament about the Brumbies at Kosciuszko. I think that's an outstanding idea.
Hey, Smithy, with your help, it'll be a bloody big protest.
Oh, you reckon? You reckon?
Mate,
all right, so
not?
What time are you doing it? Next Thursday at Quarry Street?
7 o'clock in the morning. And you know what? I've put in a request to the police. If they don't give it to me, I got a pram. I'll be mobile. I'll move up and down outside of Parliament House. As long as I'm moving, they can't stop me. It's not a protest, is
so
it?
So you want those who are against what the New South Wales government is doing against the Brumbies in Kosciuszko to turn up to Macquarie Street, to New South Wales Parliament House, and that's at 7 a.m. and join you in a protest?
Yeah, I'll be there from about 6. And mate, we'd love to have you. It's been a long time since we've shaken hands, and you're a beautiful
right.
man.
7 a.m., mate. All right, I'll try and set the alarm and try and get there. Hey,
if not, we'll do lunch.
Did you get hold of Peter Cochran?
No, I didn't.
Right.
But I have spoken to the chief of staff of a political leader, shall we say?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I've also found out, because I'm trying to work out why the Greens want to stop racing and want to stop greyhound racing, but they're supporting the Cullen.
Yeah,
but the party's divided.
They
this.
Have lost the plot,
divided.
The Greens. Listen, mate, I've run out of time. I've only got 30 seconds left. I've got to go.
Love you, brother.
Next Thursday. Thank you, mate. Much appreciated.
Bye.
There you go. That's Andrew. If you feel that strongly against what's happening to Brumbies in Kosciuszko, be there, Macquarie Street, 7 a.m. on Thursday morning. I've got to run. I'll leave you in the very capable hands of Sonia Poulton. I'm off to have a fantastic weekend, and I really hope you do too. Come back on Monday, same time. Tell your friends, tell your family. This is where it happens. We protect free speech, and you can join that particular campaign right here. This is Chris Smith on TNT Radio.